Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everybody. We've got a special giveaway today. Thanks to Andy Friedson and Cambridge University Press. We are going to give away, well, they are going to give away a copy of Andy's new book, The Economics of Healthcare, a Brief Introduction. Sebastian, how can people sign up to win?
Awesome. In order to win, you just need to share this episode on any social media you want. So if you see my tweet, click retweet, boom, you are submitted for consideration.
Excuse me. I think it's called Re-X now.
Or oh, yeah. Re-X.
Or what is it?
Rex.
I have no idea.
Rex. Or Rex. If you're in Blue Sky, Blue Sky it. If you are in Gray Sky it. Whichever sky you are. Or if it's Facebook or any other social media, Instagram, if you're sharing it, just send us, if you want to quote unquote a screenshot or whatever, receipt to hiddencurriculumpodcast@gmail.com, and you'll be submitted for consideration of winning this awesome book. Anything else for details? Oh, we'll be picking a winner probably on January 12th, so a week from the release of the episode.
Awesome. Thank you so much, and have fun listening to Andy.
Yeah, bye.
Hello, I am Sebastian Teotrio.
And I'm Alex Hollingsworth.
Welcome to The Hidden Curriculum,
a podcast where we talk about all the stuff you didn't learn in graduate school. Hey, everybody. Hope that you're doing well. We're pretty excited to bring you an episode today. Sebastian, what's your favorite meal to cook?
Favorite meal to cook?
That's right.
Okay. Oh, that's a good one. So right now, I mean, it's very seasonal. It's going to change. Right now, I'm into two things. I'm really into cooking ramen at home, but not like
instant doing ramen.
Like instant ramen, but like elevating instant ramen, you know, okay. Like I had the hard soft boiled egg and like a couple things. Ooh. So that's one thing. And then I'm really into making shashushka right now, which I'm not sure if I'm mispronouncing it. I'm probably
he's got the tomatoes and the feta and the
yeah.
You're a runny egg guy, right?
Yeah, I'm 100% a toasted bread run. Ooh, I'm getting hungry right now just thinking about it. Those are my things. Yeah. What about you, Alex?
I haven't cooked it in a while, but we have this one recipe. I think I got it from Serious Eats, where it's like it's a beef tenderloin. Excuse me. What am I made of money? It's a pork tenderloin where there's some bourbon on it, but then you light the bourbon on fire. And the recipe is fine, but honestly, I just like lighting it on fire.
Yeah, you're like,
it's a cool little thing. I use a cruddy lighter that we have that I've had for like years. I don't have a blowtorch. I should, but I don't actually have a use.
Maybe
I'll
get you that for Christmas.
Oh, that'd be fun. My wife would be terrified. Andy, what about you?
I've been really into making these sheet pan noodles, these crispy sheet pan noodles I got from the New York Times Cooking. It's like tofu and vegetables, and it's all in like a sheet pan, bakes it, and the noodles get all crispy.
I like it. We're gonna have to get some show notes recipes. That could be another episode where we just cook stuff.
We talked so much about food in this podcast. I think we should just quit this podcast and start a food podcast.
We could each cook the same recipe and compare how it looks. It would be rough.
The Hidden Cookbook.
The Hidden Cook Curriculum.
Oh, man.
We're done. Copyrighted. Don't steal it, audience of 12. All right. So our special guest today is Andrew Friedson. Andrew is the Director of Health Economics for the Milken Institute Research Department, and most recently an Associate Professor of Economics at UC Denver. And he's a health economist with a background in applied micro, does lots of public and labor and urban things. He's research interests in policy surrounding health insurance and healthcare markets. And really cool, in 2023, his first book, The Economics of Healthcare, A Brief Introduction, is going to be published by Cambridge University Press. So a big round of applause for that.
Yeah. The book's we'll put some sound effects here.
We'll add like a large audience cheering. The book is a primer on health economics and basic economics aimed at the sort of new health economics student, but that doesn't necessarily have a big background in economics or math. And he gave us a little preview of some of the chapters. It's great. Once the book's out, I'm going to be using it in my class, which is for non-econ majors. It's called An Overview of the U.S. Healthcare System. So it'll be perfect for
that
audience.
Oh, that's a perfect fit. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Andy, thank you much for being here. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. It's a beautiful day here in Denver. It's sunny and it's good.
Thanks. Awesome. Well, hey, we always ask guests to share a shareable fun fact. Can you share one?
Yeah. Oh, boy. I've got a bunch of them because I kind of collect a bunch of hobbies. But one is when I was in graduate school, I had a side gig as a comedian that I worked at. There was there was a theater, and they had a weekly, it was biweekly actually, improv show, and they paid me $50
a night
to be in their group that would go out and perform for audiences.
They paid you to perform?
They paid me, yeah. I had a paid
professional comedian.
I mean, this is very, very generous use of the word professional.
I mean, we're professional economists with a very similar generosity.
But I mean, as a grad student in Syracuse, New York, $50 every other week was, some.
That's maybe twice your money.
Was it like stand-up bits or was it improv?
No, it was improv. I was part of a group of people that they paid at the theater to come in and do stuff.
Wow, very interesting.
Did you guys have like a bit that you would use all the time, or was it straight like totally?
Oh no, you make it up every week. Okay. I just went in and made it up, shoot from the hip. Actually, so I did it for about 2 years, and then I started living with my now wife, and I no longer needed the money, and got involved with a different group that did shows for charity. And there's still an organization in Syracuse called the Syracuse Improv Collective that I was one of the founding members of too.
Very cool. Have you ever done stand-up?
I have not done stand-up. My first 2 years in Denver, I did perform at a theater in downtown Denver that I got. I auditioned and got in. That was like my hobby.
We asked Gary Hoover this because he also does stand up. And how much is this like teach? Like, what do you think the complementarities between this and teaching are?
Oh, it's humongous. It heavily influences my teaching style. Like, I'm a minimal notes, no slides, because I like to be able to just go off.
Wow.
The room. I mean, I'm in among the students, I sit next to them, ask them questions.
You rise out of the middle of the class.
Oh yeah, that's right. it's like the show Cats, where you never know which cat's gonna come talk to you. Yeah,
that's so funny because I always refer to class as like to my wife as like shows. Yeah, I got that morning matinee at 11 a.m. and then another 12:30 show.
That's right. I say the same thing. I say I've got the early show and then the late show.
Yeah. But I'm impressed because if I don't have slides, I don't know how I would sound coherent. I would be like, recognition goes brr, you know?
I have notes on a legal pad, and then I'll have slides of like data if we want to look at some data as a class, and I'll project up the data. But I like the idea of when I'm working with models, drawing the model on the board, because the students are going to be writing it in their in their notes, right? And it's like showing them, this is how you construct it. You can stop and be like, hey, it's really important to make this part of the axis really big. This intersection, and we're going to rotate around this later. Like, make sure you leave room. It slows them down. And I've always found, as a student, I found lectures that were on the board to be a lot more engaging than lectures that were done by slides.
I like it. I recently visited another university that had a brand new fancy building, and in the classrooms, there were just a bunch of circular tables with no writing surfaces. It was like a coffee shop or something with like a few TVs around. And I you got to have slides to teach in that room, right?
Are they training like clone troopers?
I don't know. But some administrator somewhere has decided like, this is the way for engagement, but like
this is the way.
Yeah, there we go. Look at all these references. We're open for sponsorship, Disney.
Yeah, Disney. Disney has sponsored us.
Disney, please sponsor us. Money, please.
I think that it's important when you teach to lean into what your personal skill set is. So for some people, they're going to be very good at working with slides because that's where their individual strengths are. Mine just aren't there, so I've never leaned into that.
Well, I liked it. That's great. So actually, we're kind of, we turned your shareable fun fact into some teaching tips. If we could expand a little bit more before we get into the topic of the day, before we talk about the textbook, we'd love to hear a little bit about your workflow, just what, how do you organize your day to day? How do you get it all done?
Oh boy, I've been thinking about this one a lot because it's really hard to describe. because I've listened to your show a bunch of times, and you have a lot of people on who have these very organized systems and are hyper vigilant about their time use. And I am on the complete opposite end of the spectrum. I am chaotic, that it is absolute chaos figuring out what I'm going to be doing on any given day. I like to describe it as my motto for getting work done is, when the wind is blowing, you hoist the sails. That I'm big on sitting down at the beginning of each day and thinking, like, where is my marginal productivity going to be the biggest today? Mm. What am I feeling like I can really crank on, and trying to crank on that? So I try to create time where I have that flexibility to adjust.
That's interesting. So I can see how that can work. What I wonder is, how does it work in the, okay, you wake up on a Tuesday and you decide for the rest of the day what you're going to work on? Or is it kind of like an hour by hour? Because I think the constant decision of, like, okay, what should I do next would get me tired.
I think it comes down to, am I still being productive? And if I'm still being productive on the thing that I'm working on, I'll try to keep going. And if I'm not being productive, then I'm very good at cutting myself off and stopping and doing something different. And sometimes that's more, it's work that's a different type of work. And sometimes it's like, I am not getting anything done. Let's not work and be productive somewhere else in my life. And then we'll make up the time at a more productive time.
So this is really interesting to me, because I want to be hyper organized, like many of the people have described, but I will, like, lapse into long periods of, like, chaos where it's, like, hard to know what's going on. And at least just focusing in on research, because it's, like, easier for me to think of where some of these problems arise or could arise. I'm just curious, like, do you think you're able to do this because you just have a really good idea of all the possible tasks you could be choosing from at any given time? Because for me, when I feel the most out of control and I'm not happy with what's going on, is when, like, I don't even know the unfinished stuff that's going on. Like, I don't know the unanswered email in my inbox, but I don't know what it is. Versus, like, oh, I didn't answer it, but I put it away, you know?
There is a little bit of structure, in the sense that I have a whiteboard, and my whiteboard has all of my projects on it. So I know what my projects that I'm trying to move forward are. And if it doesn't make it to the whiteboard, then it's just not an important thing to be working on. I also have an hour, like, my first hour each day is student and administrative task email response time. Yep. That I just block off this time. This is the time that I respond to all this stuff. And then if it comes in later in the day, it just gets kicked off till the next day when I'm responding to stuff.
That I appreciate that, because, like, I knew that you were working on lots of stuff, but I hadn't been on your website in, like, maybe a year or something. I think literally you've had, like, 15 papers come out in the past, like, since 2020. So when you're just like, oh, I, like, work on whatever, I'm like, but something is happening.
Right.
It's really successful, right? Like, it's been,
well,
you've been doing a lot. So
yeah, some of it is getting good complementarities with your team. I think that one of the reasons why I've been so productive over the past few years is that I've found good niches within the research teams that I've been working on, where I'm really firing high productivity work is my contribution. And it's, I'm not really, like, it doesn't feel like a huge grind to get the work done.
I want to, I think, highlight that in some ways that whiteboard, even though it seems so simple, it's actually very important for this workflow, right? Because that's how you put in kind of, like, all the projects, all the things that you may need to work on. And so that makes the decision of, like, okay, what I feel I'm working on next. I know that project is being touched by somebody else. That project, somebody else needs to do something. Okay, here's three projects that I can choose from. So that, even though it's so simple, it's actually really powerful, because it helps you make that decision really easy.
It's very powerful. And I had a conversation, the modern version, my old version of the whiteboard, I used to write everything on the whiteboard, and I got feeling very overwhelmed about it. And I had a conversation actually with my therapist, and he said, well, why don't you try this? And I've been doing this now. And I hate to say this, because it's going to, it'll give away some of the secret to people I may be working with as to how to get to the top of the list. Is that from time to time, like... well, yeah, it's from time to time, erase your whiteboard. So you can do this daily. You can do this weekly.
Oh, wow.
I'm gonna tell you when the time is I do this, because if I tell you, then if you're my co-author, you'll call me right before I do it so you can get the top. You just erase the whiteboard. You could do this like daily or weekly or whatever. And you set a timer for yourself for 30 seconds. And then you write your tasks on the whiteboard. And when the 30 seconds are up, you stop writing. Ooh. And if there's more tasks, they're not important enough that they need to be done high priority. And they don't make it on the whiteboard and you don't do them.
Wow. That's super interesting and dangerous, but super interesting.
Like dangerous, yeah, but sure. Like you want to make sure you write down the important things, right? I mean, right. There's a family calendar as well. I'm not like erasing my wife's birthday, right?
I crap, always forget the anniversary, like, you know.
Right, but that's cool. That's really interesting. I like that you have a much free flowing workflow, and I think something to highlight for our listeners is that Andrew is really productive. So maybe if you are thinking like, oh, but you know, do you have this, you're not going to be super productive. Actually, Andrew has been really very productive, also the past what 3-4 years, right? I would say it's one of the most productive years. Right.
I will say, I'm going to add a fun fact about Andy here. I one time was, maybe you put on Twitter, I don't have CNBC or whatever, just up at my house, but I was watching CNBC and then you came on and you were presenting. And then I noticed the really fancy textbooks behind you were actually the Harry Potter series. So, which is maybe like my favorite fact about you possible.
That's funny.
Yeah, it was Harry Potter. And then the other side was all of my Kurt Vonnegut books.
That's basically perfect.
So usually we have a section where we ask our guests to maybe promote something or a project, but we thought we can combine it with the topic of the day today. As we mentioned in the introduction, Andrew's writing a book on economics of healthcare, and we wanted to ask more questions about this process and see what we can learn from him. So that's what we're going to do in this section. Everyone is invited to check out the book. We'll link in the show notes where you can get it and when it's available. Hopefully by the time this podcast is released, it will be readily available. So to start our conversation, tell us a little bit of what this book is about.
So the book is titled Economics of Healthcare, A Brief Introduction. And the way I would put it is meant to be a non-intimidating conversational introduction to health economics for people who have no economics background, no math background, or minimal background. The idea is that I taught a course in our School of Public Health for our Master's of Public Health that was healthcare economics. And it was mostly physicians and public health people that were really interested in the economics of the sector, but you know, their training was in medicine or in social work or something like that. And I think that a lot of economics is hidden behind a lot of prerequisite courses, and you don't necessarily need all of that to be able to grasp some of the most important features. And so this book is meant to be something that you can use in a course, you know, in like a Master's of Public Health, Master's of Business Administration, Master's of Public Policy, where you want to learn about the healthcare sector, but you don't necessarily have the economics undergraduate degree or any of the math background. And you don't need it.
Is there an example of like a little quick example of a topic that you think of like, here's how we would teach it and require a lot of econ, but here's a way you can teach this concept even without that?
One of the ones that we tend to think everyone really needs to know a ton to understand is the idea of the adverse selection problem, or, you know, the death spiral. And typically when we teach this, it's like, oh, you have to solve for like a pooling equilibrium versus separating equilibrium, and you got to understand everything. All you got to understand is expected value, or like the average, right? And in the book, for example, I teach this with just a line. And I say, okay, here's a line. Everyone on this end, you get riskier. Everyone on this end, you get less risky. If you're charging everyone based on the middle risk, this side's getting a good deal. This side's getting a bad deal. But look, if these people who are getting a bad deal decide they want to leave, then that's going to shift everything over on our line. And then it happens again. It shifts everything over on the line, happens again. And you don't need all the math. I can do it in 2 pages.
So you kind of answer a little bit of like the motivation to write the book. You probably saw that, you know, there are not other books out there in the market that have this approach. But even with that, maybe a lot of us think that there are things that are in the market that don't exist, but we don't choose to then write the book. So what was it behind this, you know, maybe your own personal or professional reasons of why you wanted to write the book?
I thought it would be fun,
to be honest.
I thought it would be, it was fun, to be honest. And I think this comes back to the idea of you've got to think about what are the things that work well with your skill set, right? I like talking about economics. I like being more conversation about economics. The other part of it is that we were talking about finding the part of a project that you're really productive on. My part is writing. Another fun fact about me is I used to work as a writing tutor as an undergrad. So I write a lot. Writing is my favorite part of the research project process.
You're about to get flooded with email.
Yeah. At Milken Institute, I no longer do academic publications. Go straight to policy. So I'd been thinking about this for a while. This came a little bit out of, I'm part of a group that meets, it's partly a kind of like a support group. It's called Teaching and Health Economics. I think that Melanie Gouldy and Monica Aswani run it right now. And it's just like a Zoom support group that we'd meet during COVID and talk about teaching and share best practices. And everyone was always complaining about their textbooks. And I kind of just started thinking a lot about, well, if I was going to have a textbook that would do something that the other textbooks don't do, what would it be? And I kept thinking back to this course I taught in the School of Public Health, where, you know, I'm trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, because most of the textbooks that are written for upper level undergraduate economics majors.
Right. That makes sense. Was there any incentive from your tenure track job for you to write a book? So in other fields, for example, political science, I think writing a book is an important part of your research package. But I'm not so sure if that's across all the fields.
But and that's like a book about research, though, right? Like, so this is a textbook, which, so even in those fields, I'm not
that's
sure
true. That's fair.
Writing a textbook.
That's yeah. Fair. So this is a post-tenure project. So I had tenure and then did a little bit of soul searching as to what would be the thing that I would most enjoy that would also fit into my job. And this is what I came up with. The other part of it is that in our particular tenure and promotion criteria, publishing a book is something that fits in, and it doesn't specify if it's a textbook or not a textbook. So technically this would count as creative activities. And so we're evaluated on research and creative activities. So
A
book with a high quality publisher, which this is, would count as a like top tier creative activity.
I see. So in your institution, you like would have gotten a star on your forehead for the book.
Oh yeah, no,
that's a weird phrase.
Would have been a
is that a phrase?
Well, you know,
a star on your. I think it's your. It's like feather in your cap.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe it's like a
maybe star on your. I've never heard that one either.
Like you know, it. Like a little sticker, sticker of like, hey,
like the football players. Like I tackled someone good, no. So I get a sticker on my helmet.
No, like a little sticker. But so I guess like we should speak honestly about this. My sense is that that's not across all institutions, right?
It's not across all institutions.
Right, okay.
That's right.
I mean, I have heard examples, not from the people themselves, so I want to be careful, but I have heard examples where people have been like, oh, this person wrote a popular press book that like was a New York Times bestseller, and then their home institution was like, should have written another AAR. Or, you know, something like that, you know, we're like, and granted, that's like not the types of places we're affiliated with, but I was like surprised when I heard that.
But I'm also not trying to maximize the utility of my department or of my institution. Yeah. I'm trying to maximize my own personal utility. And this is a project that I found personally fulfilling. So I did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also like, to be totally honest, I think that like the department's utility probably is maximized by like a really good textbook that helps undergrads learn, or like a popular press book that like. Millions of people read. I think that's a bizarre reaction, but
my school was incredibly supportive. Yeah. This was my sabbatical project. So I took my sabbatical. My sabbatical application was hilarious because typically you have to write like these long things about where you're going to go, why it's valuable. And for me, it was like, what are you going to do? I'm going to write a book. Why is this valuable? It's a book. It has my name on it and people will read it.
Hey, that makes sense. Wanted to raise that because I don't want people to have an expectation that all institutions are going to be supportive like this. I think it's great if you find institutions that are supportive of these endeavors, and hopefully we should have more like that. But, you know, just didn't want to create an expectation for a young scholar to be like, oh, this is how, you know, everyone is going to get treated and stuff. So
I think that's right. But if you feel, if you look deep inside your heart and you feel like you have a book inside of you that wants to come out, then let that book come out.
Yeah. I like that. Let the book come out.
Except mine's going to be like about like some poorly written sci-fi character or something. Instead.
Okay. So let's say you have the idea, you have the vision. I don't know, like, talk us a little bit of what is this process like. Like, do you just like write the book first, find a publisher? Do you find a publisher and then write the book? Like, how does that work?
Yeah. So you definitely don't write the book first. You want to find a publisher, but you are going to need to write some sample chapters. So there's two ways to go about doing this. There's the way I did it, which I got extremely lucky. And then there's the other way to do it, which I had on my radar if I did not get extremely lucky.
Okay.
So what I mean by I got extremely lucky is that I had one of those marketing calls from Cambridge Press that was like, hey, we'd like to talk to you about your textbook and what you like and what you don't like. Right. And so the editor from Cambridge and I had a little Zoom call where he was trying to like do some market research. And at the end of the Zoom call, I just said to him, hey, can I pitch an idea to you? And he said, sure. And so I told him my idea for the textbook. And he said, you know, that's really interesting. It sounds actually like it would fit a niche in the market that we don't have anything for and that there isn't anything there for. What I'm going to send you is our typical book application. So they have like an application proposal form where you talk about what your goals are for the manuscript, why you think it's needed, where it fits in the market, what types of courses it is, and what are there the competitor books that exist. And in this case, there really weren't any competitors. Like I listed like the top health econ textbooks and said, but none of these are geared towards this type of course.
Yeah.
Right. And so where my process continued is that I filled out, you know, the application proposal form, you know, it was like 3-5 pages of text as to why the thing was. And then I wrote 3 sample chapters. And so then what they
Because they ask or because
they
you were.
The three, yeah, they asked for sample chapters.
Okay.
It said 1-3 sample chapters, and because we're all overachievers, you write 3 sample chapters. And so then they sent those sample chapters out for review, and they got reviews back from anonymous people who are in the market for this type of textbook.
So, and so is that, sorry, other faculty or is that?
Yeah, other faculty.
People? Okay.
They sent it out to faculty that I still don't know who these people are.
Okay. It was me, Andrew. It was me. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know. It wasn't. they would never.
The reviews were overwhelmingly positive, saying, yeah, we could really use a book like this.
Mm.
And so then they offered me a contract.
Wow.
And then we did a little bit of negotiation over the contract. I know some people who had recently published books. And so they were generous and shared their contracts with me. And so I was able to get some finer points of what I would like in the contract. And then we signed a contract and then I was off to writing.
What's the standard structure of a book contract? Is it like we pay you a fixed cost and that's
so there's,
it?
There's 2 main moving parts in a book contract. Part of it is there an advance or not an advance? An advance is money that they pay you up front that if you do not earn enough money on the book, then you don't have to pay the advance. So it's kind of like we're paying you this lump sum. And then if you do better, you start making royalties. That's called earning out your advance. And earning out your advance is usually a sign that your book has been very successful. The other part of it is what percentage of revenue do you make off of each book? And in my case, the big thing I was negotiating over was for something called an escalator, which is when you sell more copies, you get a better percentage. So if you hit a certain number of copies sold, you get a better percentage.
Okay, interesting.
And then the contract also has things like dates for delivery, and then what other supplemental material might you be providing.
What about pricing? Is that part of the contract?
That was not part of the contract, but that was part of the conversation that we had, because things can change between when you sign the contract and when the book actually goes in production. But when we were described, so it is kind of in the contract in the sense that like this book is going to be between this many and this many words, and it's going to have between this many and this many figures, and they're going to be color or not color. And all of that determines the pricing. So we had a conversation early on once we knew a contract was coming as to like, what do we want the price point to be? So we're shooting for around $50 for the book.
Gotcha. That's interesting because it's like when I think about adopting a textbook, I'm like pretty sensitive to that. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that they gave you those ranges, but the idea that like the publisher incentive and your incentive are like, so like the, cause the way you design the content to fit into those parameters to get the book price down, you might've like started at a different point.
Oh yeah, for sure.
If you knew all the parameters, like, so
but part of the conversation that we were having when we were talking about the market for textbooks is also that, okay, there isn't really anything that's conversational, non-intimidating. There also really isn't anything that's super affordable. Right. Yeah. So one of the, I mean, when we're thinking about like what goes into a manuscript that I'm going to write, we're like, well, it's going to be this strategy and this. We don't think about the market. But in the case of a book, like this is a product that's going to go out to the market. So one of the things that's really important is, you know, let's think about the inputs and then let's think about what kind of price range we're looking to shoot for. And mm-hmm. so we were shooting to put something out that's in the price range of like, you know, the mostly harmless econometrics of the world. Right. We want a book that feels like that we're taking a more intimidating topic, making it simpler, making it more digestible.
You said that you got lucky because you had this conversation with the marketing person. What was the other avenue that you were going to walk?
So the other avenue is you get an agent and then your agent can.
Like James Bond, you mean, right?
Yes. Yeah. So you get a another colleague. He used to be in my department. He left and went to Duke, who's a history of economic thought guy, Steve Medema. And he's published a whole bunch of books. And so he has an agent. He said, look, you know, if I know that when I went to go do the book proposal, I talked with him a bunch and said, this is what I'm working on. I know you've published a lot. Can I get some advice from you? He said, it looks like you're doing everything right. But if for some reason Cambridge doesn't want this, I'm more than happy to set you up with my agent. And then the agent will take the book and shop it around and get you the best contract that you can get. So there's some trade-offs here. An agent is going to probably be able to get you slightly better terms on the contract. An agent is going to increase your probability of success. On the other hand, an agent is going to take a percentage.
I was going to say, that's really interesting. And to be honest, it's a little bit like that's much more clear. It's a little bit different of how I conceptualize it. And I'll tell you why. And you can tell me if like these are, I'm looking at exceptions rather than the rule. But you know, I was thinking about the example of, I think it's Scott and Nick Huntington-Klein and Bruce Hansen, who I think my impression is that they wrote the books and then they were like finding contracts to like with publisher and stuff like that. But it seems like you took a little bit of a different approach as like just doing a book proposal. But I don't know if there's like a difference between better or not better.
Yeah. And I guess like, I know you're trying to ask Andy a question, but I'm curious just to follow up on that. My impression of at least Bruce Hansen's thing was they taught a class for a while where they had lecture notes that became a book. And it seems like you probably were teaching this class for a while.
Right. Yeah. Right? So I had all the material. Yeah. I knew what was going into the book. There were a few chapters that were kind of like my dream chapters of like, I'd really like to do more on this. There isn't typically a chapter on this. I have a lecture on it or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this wasn't like I was going to be going off into the Amazon to document some rare plants that may or may not exist, and then they're going to sign a contract for the book. This was like, I knew the material. Mm. I had years of experience doing this material. It was pretty clear that I'd be able to write. And I was able to bang out like 3 high quality sample chapters. So they knew what the product was more or less going to look like.
Mm-hmm. Some quick questions. You wrote it in Word, you wrote it in LaTeX. What did you use and why?
I used Word because it's what I use. I use Word.
Okay, cool. But it wasn't that the publisher was asking you anything specifically either.
No, I mean, I think they had a preference for Word.
Okay.
But not like a super strong preference. I think when they were sending me the files for like, okay, this is how you hand off materials. They're like, if it's Word files, just give us the Word files. If it's LaTeX, but here's a paragraph of what you got to do. Right. Okay.
So, gotcha. Okay. So you submitted the proposal, you get the reviews, it was approved. So then how did you, like, what's the, like, what happens after? So how do you decide to organize the book? Like, there's so many things I could go on it. And like, do you read other books or like, you know,
so
what was
with
that whole
the
process?
Proposal, I also had a proposed outline of the entire book. So when I sent them the sample chapters, I also sent them, here is like a slightly more detailed table of contents. So as I've been building my table of contents, I've been taking my outline and like simplifying it back to what the actual titles are, or subtitles or subheadings within the book.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to have the entire book sketched out at the time that I sent them the proposal.
I see. And so that part of the thinking process was A, drawing from your experience of teaching the class and maybe like playing around with ideas of order or things like that.
One of the other things I did is that when I was in the process of getting ready to write the proposal, when I knew that I was going to write a proposal, I interviewed a bunch of people that I knew that teach health economics courses in these various settings to get a sense of what are your needs,
right.
Which topics do you wish were done better? Which topics, if you were designing your ideal, health econ course
right.
from scratch, what would go in it to try to get a sense of, I'm not the person who teaches this topic. What do other people do to try right. to see what's important?
And this is where probably being in that group was really helpful because you got to hear
drawn
a lot
from those people. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm curious now you've got the book contract, let's say, fast forward the books, coming out off the press. What do you do now? Is it your responsibility to market? Do other people market? What are the next
steps? Yeah, so there's a whole marketing team. I mean, any marketing that I can do by, for example, going on a podcast would certainly be viewed positively, but I'm not supposed to be the primary person. Cambridge, they are supposed to be the people pushing the book through their marketing behemoth that they have.
Right? Yeah, I it's always so interesting to me. Like, I try to think of like the way I've discovered the textbooks that I use or the material that I use in my class. And like, I'm not sure I've ever picked up, like, let me read Cambridge's new offerings this year or something, but I hear about it from like, Sebastian's like, oh, I use this book. Or like, I ask, a colleague or something. And, maybe the original genesis is something like a marketing material that was put in an office box.
I think there's going to be no substitute for word of mouth, that if your product is high quality, then it's
right.
going to get around by word of mouth.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, when I got my first job here and I was going to teach socially causal inference class for masters in public policy, all the books that I had in my head about metrics and all stuff were very highly technical. And I was like, these are not going to be friendly. So I like spend a lot of time Googling libraries, asking people about books and like seeing them. And it was it was a very long process. And at the end, I landed in this book called Real Stats by Michael Beatty that I really like and that I've been using it since. But it was like, this long process. And then I've been, to be honest, recommending that to other people because I really like the book. And everyone has like, tell me like, oh yeah, this book is really great for that particular level, So that's evidence of that word of mouthness that happens for sure. Yeah, what are some lessons that you learned from then this process? Like if you were to do it again, what things that you would do again and not do again?
About halfway through the writing process, I was making a lot of figures for some of the chapters and I was really bad at it. I still am really bad at it. I mean, these came out in like Microsoft Paint. And I took a chunk of my research funds and hired a student from our visual arts department to do the pictures for me.
Oh, wow.
And that was a very good decision.
I'm just curious, is the process like you write it on a whiteboard and then have a meeting and then you're like, make this, but good.
But good. Cooler. I mean, at that point, I had enough Microsoft Paint stuff that I was like, okay, can you take this? Right? Can you make it good? And he's like, yeah, I can make it good. No, I actually knew enough about design software, that I was able to, I used a program called Inkscape, to do some very basic, vector files. So I was able to get by and make some pretty ugly looking things. And, he came in and essentially anything that would take me like an hour to make, I'd be like, hey, can you make this better? And he would get it back to me in like 10 minutes. And
oh, wow.
Tremendously better. Just the gains from specialization were off the charts.
Right.
Yeah. As an economist, you are probably very happy by that. I'm happy by that. But I could see other people being like, oh, it's so frustrating. But you're like, oh, look at that.
Oh, no, this is fantastic.
Yeah, this is amazing.
I thought I was the biggest idiot for not thinking of this immediately. I mean, I didn't even format my own dissertation. I hired someone to do that. Right. That it's... gains from specialization are a thing and you should be doing them as much as possible.
How much does the publisher had input on what you were producing and like Could tell us a little bit about the schedule. Like, was it like 3 months, 4 months, you know, like a little bit about that process.
So the writing process took about a year. And what we did is we had the chapters come in batches. So there's 19 chapters. So we did them in 6, 6, and 7. And it was about every 3.5 months, I would give them a batch of chapters. And then they would send those chapters out for anonymous review. We'd get about 19, 20-ish reviews back. And then I would go and make changes to the chapters, content edits, based on the the responses that I would get back, right? So you get feedback. Effectively, you get back like 19 referee reports on your on your chapters. Yeah, but each one is like,
you're used to it, you know?
No, it was actually shocking because it's like you get R1 every single time, that they're all positive, because instead of this being a paper where like they're trying to play goalie, you've got something that they can potentially use.
Right, help. Right?
And so instead of telling you to do something or jump through some superfluous hoop that is, you know, going to make your things this percent robust, they're looking for things that are strictly utilitarian. Mm. Right. So all of the feedback that I got was incredibly helpful.
How did you organize yourself to write a book? Like, did you have like every day I'm going to write 200 words? Did you have like I want to write a book today, and so you spend the whole day writing the book? Like, how did that work for you process wise?
Yeah, it was very much today feels like a good day to write, and then I'd write. Okay. And then today doesn't feel like a good day to write, and I wouldn't write. I wish I had a better way that I kept myself on track, but the best way to put it is that this was my favorite thing to work on.
So you were just really excited about it.
So I was trying to like find excuses to not do my other projects so I could have
That's fair. That's really nice to have something work-wise that it like look you have to look forward to. So
yeah, I wish I had some better time organization for how to write a book other than really enjoy writing the book.
Yeah. Is there, you know how in movies you like film a lot and then you have to edit them, but then there's like the director's cut so you can see all the additional scenes. Is there something like that with the book where like you have a lot of things that you're not putting there, but
I have some, so the book has a lot of jokes in it.
okay.
It's got some really bad dad jokes in it. And some of them were a little like too much. And so, so some of those got cut. There's still some, don't worry, there's still jokes in the book. But there are some jokes that are even worse than those jokes.
Those
jokes are not in the book.
I'm excited for the book's director's cuts edition.
You can like highlight it in red. Like, this was the joke that was cut. You be the judge. University, good, bad decision.
That's funny.
I had one joke, not really even a joke. It was more like a funny example that in the most recent round of reviews, one of the reviewers was like, I didn't really like this one. And I was like, well, I'm keeping it anyway. And the publishers let me keep that one.
That's funny. So just to kind of get us at the end of the conversation, I mean, this is a little bit of a weird question, but you wrote this book for teaching, you know, healthcare economics. Are you going to use it? Because now your new position, you don't actually have to teach. Is that like, do you feel bad about it?
Well, this way I get to avoid the trap of being the professor who's like, buy my book. I stay out of that particular conflict of interest. But yeah, I mean, I think I'll still find some time to use the book. Like, just because I'm out of academics, one, it doesn't mean I'm out of academics forever. Maybe someday, you know, and also maybe someday I'll, you know, pick up an adjunct course or something like that. But this is just something I had a lot of fun doing, and I'm going to keep supporting the book. It'll just be my side hustle as opposed to my job.
Can you tell us a little more about the production process?
Yeah. So where I am as we're recording right now is I'm in the process of handing everything off to the publisher, that I've got about, you know, like 3 hours of content edits left to make. And then everything is going to go off to them. And then it goes to Galley Proofs markup. So then they'll move in like proof editors and people who turn it from like a bunch of Word files into an actual book in book layout form. And then we've got to go through like line by line and make sure everything displays correctly, make sure everything was translated correctly. I mean, that's what Galley Proofs are, right? It's like the actual, like, you know, like when you do your article and you get to see what the article is actually going to look like, it's going to be that, but for an entire book.
So you have to read your whole book again?
I am going to have to read my whole book again, yes.
That sounds painful.
It's actually impossible, though, right? Like, I work on the same introduction over and over again, and then someone will be like, oh, there's a typo on page two. I'm like, how?
I'm saving this for my suggestion of the week, that I've got a little hack for you for that.
Every time I have to like reread my papers, I like fall asleep because I've read them so many times that
I'm
like,
a hack.
Okay.
We'll save that. That's in my back pocket. Yeah. So then the book has to go into like physical production. So it'll get, Cambridge produces it over in England, and it will take a little while because they'll print it in England and it has to come over on a boat. And
can you go to England and see like the early version or something?
I could go to England and see the early version.
So I bought Emily Oster's British version of Expecting Better because I thought it was an updated version. I like found one on Amazon.
It's fresher.
Well, it says instead of like bachelor party, it says like stag party. Like someone went through and like changed to like slang. So I have this like hilarious version, and I really hope we're gonna get a labor economics version or whatever of your book. Like just put all the U's in weird spots.
The color.
Our S's. I need it.
That would be super awesome. I would love that version of the book. And while all this is happening, like once we're done with galley proofs, I will then be producing the test banks and the lecture slides and things like that.
Oh, so that's going to be a company book. Like,
yep, there'll be test banks. There'll be or question banks. You can use them for whatever you want. And there'll be slides. And there will also be some like a document that has like, hey, if you're looking for some additional readings or some additional podcasts, this is the type of stuff I would be using in my course.
So now we're going to move to the next section, which is the lightning round section. In this section, you just have to answer yes or no, or if it's A or B, pick A or B. And we'll do a timer to see how many questions of these you can answer in 1 minute. It seems like the main challenge for our guests is to not deliver. Because everyone's like, well, it depends if like the season is right. So that's why we put the 1 minute timer
here. So there will be no digression.
We're going to try to stop you from digressing.
Each of these could be a whole conversation, but I'm ready.
All right, so we'll start with a timer one. Cover letters, do they matter or not?
Yes.
What's the difference between a bratwurst and a hot dog?
Hot dog is good. I don't know what a bratwurst is.
Prefer hot dog toppings.
Sauerkraut and mustard.
Preferred writing, software, LaTeX, or Word?
Word.
Stata or R?
Stata.
Pepsi or Coke?
Coke.
PowerPoint or Beamer?
PowerPoint.
What's the part of research you find the most boring?
Arguing with a referee.
Data analysis or writing?
Writing.
Favorite conference?
The National Tax Association.
Ooh. Oh, wow. Nice. Current favorite paper?
Blood Money by John Dooley and Emily Gallagher.
Ooh. Okay. That was times. Tell us what the paper is about. I don't think I know it.
Yeah. This is a very, very cool paper. It's got everything. The paper is about plasma donation centers and showing that when a plasma donation center opens up in a location, that it decreases people's reliance on payday loans.
What?
Oh, it's got everything. It's got health econ. It's got household finance. It's got people getting away from bad financial instruments. And it's
got a murder.
An awesome pun title.
Yeah, that
paper's
is cool.
Got everything.
That is it like published that. Already or is it working paper?
It's a working paper.
Got it.
Cool. I like it.
Although, great. Who knows? By the time this podcast comes out, maybe it's published. But
it'll probably be 5 years old at our rate.
Great. Thank you so much for those insights. Every week, we like to ask our guests for a recommendation of the week. This could be anything: a podcast, a command, an app, a song, a quote, a book, a kitchen recipe, anything that improves your life in a small way. Andrew, what is your recommendation of the week?
So this comes from my days as a writing tutor, and it's how to proofread your own writing without getting lost in the flow and missing the typos. And it is to proofread your paper backwards. Read the last sentence first, and then the next last sentence, and then the next last sentence, and it breaks the flow, and you evaluate each sentence individually, and it keeps you from getting caught up in your own fantastic train of thought, missing all of your own typos.
Wow. Okay, that is a really good tip. I don't think I've ever heard of that. I like that a lot. Alex, what is yours?
All right. So I the show is not done yet, so this will give you some idea what it is. But I've been watching the show The Last of Us on HBO. It's a great show. I love it. It's a very violent show, like post-apocalyptic.
Did you play the video game
and stuff? I did not, but I now don't want to play I don't have a console.
Right.
I wouldn't want to play because I don't want to know what happens. Right. I want to the show is pretty well done. So
yeah. You don't want to know that the both characters die.
Oh, look at that.
I'm just kidding. I don't know.
Listen, the podcast is over. We can't be friends anymore.
Yeah, that's fair. Cool. My recommendation of the week is going to be a weird one. Cause I think this is something that I actually recommend people in real life, that I always feel weird talking about products. So I have a smartwatch, and I always feel like most smartwatch looks ugly, but there is one called the Withings smartwatch that I'll put the links in the show notes. And it just looks like a regular watch, but it has some smart features of like recording whatever heartbeat and exercises. And also you can see notifications. But I think the coolest thing is just it looks like a regular watch, but it's a smart watch. So I like it. People have given me a lot of compliments on it. Barton Willich, another economist, also owns it. So maybe
Seth Friedman too.
Yeah. Oh, well, there you go. We have a lot of good people that recommend it. So that's my recommendation of the week. Also, well, thanks for being here with us today. If people want to find more about you and your work, where should they go?
I don't know.
they can connect with you on Twitter.
Yeah, they can connect with me on Twitter. I am at Friedson Andrew. Don't go to Ed Andrew Friedson. That is a politician.
I mean, you're moving to D.C. That could be you soon. You could be a competing politician.
That's true.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and say that one's very unlikely. I did donate a few dollars to his campaign so I get a yard sign. City Council.
That's funny. Great. Well, that's all that we have for you folks today. Make sure you subscribe and leave us a review, and thank you for tuning in. Bye.
Thanks, everybody. Great.
Did okay.
Natural.